Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
And you were listening to Buffalo Grass by the late Rick Gilman, who graciously donated that song to us. And you are listening to the Writer's Block here on LA Talk Radio. I am the host that is not James Christina, only because Jim has bowed out for the evening, and we hope Jim gets to feeling a little bit better. I am Richard Polinelli. I'm the other half of the Tuscany Bay team that just brings chaos and mayhem wherever we go. Fortunately, some sanity will be here because we are joined by our wonderful co-host, Bobby Jean Bell. Miss Bobby Jean, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. I still can't get over the ending of the book for tonight. I just finished it like 45 minutes ago, and I'm just, my head is still, this isn't with all of us yet. It's still there.
it's a very good book that we're going to be talking about, and we do have our author waiting in the wings. And is it just me, Bobby, or every time there's a pause that goes longer than half a second, we start thinking it's last week all over again?
But it's not.
It's not. So hopefully we won't have just blank issues and us talking over the ads that we can't hear for whatever reason. What do you say we get into our guest this week? She is Lori Stevens. She has written a very, very good book called In Twilight's Hush, which is a Gabriel McRae novel. And I believe that is a series. So we're going to talk to her about the latest book. We're going to talk to her about the series. But first, I think we better officially welcome Lori Stevens to the Writer's Block. Lori, how are you doing?
I'm doing so well. I'm really happy to be here. And I want to thank you, Richard and Bobby, for having me on, giving me the opportunity to, I guess it's safe to say tonight, unless we're across the world somewhere. Yeah. Thank you so much. And I'm sorry to hear about Jim.
Well, I think he'll be back at it next week. He better be because of who the guest is, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But yeah, thank you for being on tonight. And why don't you tell us a little bit about not only the book, but the character who's kind of driving the whole series, because this is a very fascinating character that you've created.
Oh, thank you. He's a damaged detective. There's been a lot of damaged detectives in literature and on the episodics and film. I wanted to make him burdened by something a little more buried under the manholes kind of thing. He's burdened by childhood sexual abuse, and he has been struggling with it. So on the outside, he's had to be sort of a tough guy because of his line of work. But on the inside, it just stabs at him all the time. So he's doing the right thing. He wants to be a better person. He wants to try to grasp some happiness like we all do. And so he goes to therapy. He's under therapy for it. That's helping him cope with PTSD. And at the same time, the cases that he solves in each book triggers a key point in his therapy. Just one of those weird fictional coinkidinks. And so that's basically what the story is about. The thing that I've liked about Gabriel is he is someone who's trying. He's not willing to just sit in his own mud, but is someone who tries to be proactive with his own mental health.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. He's a detective with the LA County Sheriff's Department. which is one thing I wanted to ask you. Why do you pick the sheriffs instead of LAPD? Because most authors, they want to go with the big LAPD. So that kind of caught my attention that he was a sheriff's department detective. Was there a reason for that?
That was a really astute observation, Richard, because I don't think most people care. I didn't think anyone, you know, would notice. But the reason he's with the sheriff's department is their rules are slightly different. I did a lot of the police procedurals fascinate me, like forensics. So I did a lot of research. And the first thing is that he loves nature. He loves the solitude. He loves the mountains. So for me, placing him as an LAPD cop, right, where his beat is always the city, would not work. I wanted him to have the Santa Monica Mountains as part of his beat. And that's the sheriff's department. So yeah, it is a little different. And the rules are a little different.
Yeah, I used to live in the Antelope Valley and then in Simi Valley. So I know, I've known a lot of the sheriff's deputies over the years. And yeah, that is a much different area that they kind of patrol. That's kind of their ground. You've got the high desert. And then you can be in snow-covered mountains within, what, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, depending on traffic. So, yeah, it's a much different beat for them. And I was wondering if that's why you picked him to be in the in that department as opposed to downtown L.A., where, you know, we, all the TV shows seem to go.
Yeah, because also, you know, think of the people. You've got Malibu. You've got, you know, Calabasas, you've got areas where these books take place, which are, you know, they're not LA proper, although he does go into LA proper. His girlfriend is the medical examiner, so she's there. But yeah, I definitely wanted him to be more in the sheriff's department. You deal with a different kind of animal out there. A lot of mm-hmm. search and rescue, people get hiking, get trapped, body dumps, things like that. It's a different sort of thing that goes on out there.
Yeah, it's definitely different. And he's kind of assigned a different kind of case, too, as we get into this book. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the case he finds himself right in the middle of?
Well, he was, you know, a homicide cop, and he was not on the cold case unit in the unsolved units. The reason he, in this book, in Twilight's Hush, he gets assigned to a cold case as sort of a break, to give him a break, because he doesn't think that much action's going to happen there. You've got a cold case, 30 years old. He can sort of step back and take his time with it. And the only reason he's doing that, as opposed to working an active homicide in the normal department that he's in, is because in The Mask of Midnight, which is the book prior to In Twilight's Hush, he actually has a run-in with a nemesis of his, a serial killer. And what their interaction, their confrontation becomes in that book makes him have to sort of do a little bit of a recover. And so that's why his lieutenant puts him on a cold case and transfers him to the cold case unit. And it turns out to be sort of fortuitous for him, because he finds out that he is a little bit of an intuitive in this book. I didn't want to lose any fans of the thriller series by touching on the paranormal, but I thought, well, where does someone go when they've done a lot of work on themselves, like self-help, self-discovery? You become more enlightened. You just do, whether you believe in it or not. And he just becomes more of an intuitive man. And I kind of liked that role reversal, you know, about it doesn't, you know, intuition doesn't always have to belong to women. It can be a sort of a fluid thing too. And I think, you know, hey, the great chefs in the world are men. Why can't great intuitives be, you know, men? So,
Bobby, I know you got some questions, so why don't you jump on in there and let her have it.
Let me have it, Bobby.
This was a fabulous read. I had a little late start, a little later in the week than normal getting started, and then I just didn't want to put it down. I'm eager to read the other books in the series. I must say that you make some references to the previous book, which I think is important. I'm not sure I could handle the previous book from what little you share about it. But this character is so engaging, as is his fiance, Dr. Ming Li. Mm-hmm. They're a really interesting couple. Tell us a little, is she in the previous books as well? And can you tell us a little bit about their relationship?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, she's in from the very beginning. In the beginning, he's this guy that, it's a book called The Dark Before Dawn. And he's this guy that's really, he suffers from like road rage. I mean, you mean it. He's stuck in traffic. He gets out of his car. He beats the hell out of someone. And he's
that's
just
LA.
A good place. Well, it's LA. He's not in a good place. And he likes her. They've worked together at that point for a while, just as friends, as professionals. But she's attracted to him. She's kind of attracted to the darkness in him. She's a high-powered, very successful career woman. And that's sort of her faltering a little bit, is she's sort of going for a guy on the dark side, which probably she gets a lot of warnings about in the first book for good reason. And he's very filled with self-doubt, even to the point where he's starting to think he's a murderer. And that's what The Dark Before Dawn's about. Mm-hmm. So he's a mess. She's falling for him. But through the subsequent books, their relationship develops. And it's funny, I was doing a couple of speaking engagements at UCLA, and the students of creative writing read the books, and they talked about, they did papers on the role reversals. And I just did a blog about this, the role reversals between Gabriel and Ming. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Like, what role reversals? And then they started pointing out all the things, and that she's this breadwinner and he makes less money than her, that he does the cooking and she can't cook worth beans. And so they started making all these things, and I realized they do have a very interesting yin-yang relationship that it's very fluid between the two of them, mm-hmm. which I didn't mean to do. But
well, sometimes that kind of organically happens when you're working with your characters and you're developing characters over a series. You know, I think sometimes the author doesn't realize half the time until somebody points it out, and you're like, oh yeah, okay. So I think that's just normal for us authors to kind of let the characters develop themselves, and we're along for the ride.
Mm-hmm. Do you both do that? Do you both sort of pants it a little bit?
Well, no, you know what? I have a series that is two books in, and the character that has become the main character because it's being told from his point of view was never intended to be more than just an introductory character to set the story up for the two main characters. So, you know, that's just one of those, like I said, it organically happened, and all of a sudden I'm looking at like, okay, so I guess he's going to be he'll be the main guy, and we'll just see where it goes. You know, I think it happens for all authors.
Yeah.
And I think Jim would probably say the same thing with a couple mm-hmm. of his characters too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have another I know we need to go to a break in a moment,
no,
but we have another very engaging character, Carmen Jeanette, is that her last name?
Yeah.
Carmen Jeanette. She's kind of the psychic to the stars, an interesting character. Would you expand a little bit about her? And I'm assuming she's not in the other books, and I wonder if we'll see her again.
She is not. She makes her debut in Twilight's Hush, and I'm thrilled to see that people have really accepted her as a character. They like her. I just wasn't sure where she would fit in the grand scheme of things. But the readers have told me that it seems to be a thumbs up with Carmen, which I'm happy to see. She probably will make an appearance again, because I ended up liking the relationship she had with Gabriel. It is professional. I would not assume to see any kind of hanky panky. I would consider him a very loyal guy to Ming, except for in the second book, in Deep Into Dusk, they had their issues. But yeah, there was a, you know, in the great thing of noir, I had to introduce a femme fatale, but that was done in the second book. Carmen's not, although she does have some of that fatale kind of thing in the beginning where she tries to flirt with Gabriel and get him into a little trouble. She's not really a femme fatale at all. She's a nice person. She's just a, she wants fame. She wants fame and fortune, but I think she learns a little bit of a lesson by the end of the book. She's humble. Yeah.
She does. Yeah, was she part of your sort of original cast of characters, or did you find a need to introduce her to make the plot all work?
That's a really good question, Bobby. I didn't think of it before, but now that you mention it, I did not plan her. The only thing that I planned was that I felt it was important for Gabriel to have sort of a psychic as a wingman. Whether it would have been a man or woman, I wasn't sure. I didn't really know how I would place her character. I decided, because I love New Orleans and I love some of that Southern Gothic kind of culture, I wanted to insert a little bit of that, you know, voodoo kind of thing. So I, as her character developed, I wanted her to be of that ancestry and to have come from there. She even, in the book, you can see she has a bar that she had reassembled after it was destroyed in a saloon in New Orleans in the in a different parish. She had it brought all the way to LA so she could reconstruct that in her living room. And I just thought that, I just thought she was kind of a cool character as I was writing her. I liked her a lot. There were things I didn't like about her. I didn't like the way she was really capitalizing on her fame and how she wanted to hang out with the politician because she thought they would be a star couple. But I didn't admire that. But I could see how a human being would do that, for sure.
Sure.
There's a I need to jump in real quick because we've got to take a break. So everybody grab your favorite beverage and take advantage of the next 60 seconds as we listen to some words from LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. You know, for years I've been telling you about the benefits of LA Talk Radio and how easy it is to get your own show. Well, today is no different. Go to www.latalkradio.com. Find the button that says Become a Host and punch that button. Fill out the easy-to-find form, and Mr. Sam Hassan will be delighted to walk you through the rest of it. And before you know it, you'll be broadcasting live worldwide right here on LA Talk Radio. We're not just a podcast. We are live radio. So why not go there? Go to latalkradio.com. Find the button that says Become a Host and become your own host on your own live radio show right here at LA Talk Radio.
And we are back on the Writer's Block, Richard Polinelli, Bobby Jean Bell, and our guest, Laurie Stevens. And if you'd like to call in and ask our guest a question or ask one of us a question or call me a name, I mean, I'm used to it, you can call 323-203-0815 and we will get you on and you can ask your question. In the meantime, we're going to get back to the book In Twilight's Hush. And there's something that I noticed in addition to the Sheriff's Department, LAPD, and I'm thinking maybe I missed something or maybe this was a red herring, so I want to find out. There are three times in the book you mentioned the time 3:15.
Yes.
One is with Carmen, an event with Carmen at 3:15 in the afternoon. The other two are Gabriel at about 3:15 in the morning. What was behind the 3:15?
Yeah, what's that all about?
Yeah, did I miss something or were you just playing with us when you threw those in?
No, that was the time that Nancy would have died.
Okay.
But I didn't say that because that's not a spoiler.
Right. Well, it is a cold case after all.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of know.
We find that out, you know.
I was just wondering because you made such great points to point that out, and then it's like I didn't see anything, and I thought, well, maybe there's something I missed, and yeah, that makes sense.
Well, and it's not just, as you know, Richard, it's not just that they look over at the clock and it's 3:15. There's something that happens which, you know, causes the individual to look over at the clock.
We're not giving away.
Right. You need to read the book to find out what happens at 3:15.
Well, yeah, and it was interesting that that added to the sense of mystery and the solution as to what had happened and who was responsible. I read a lot of mysteries and I hate it when I'm halfway through the book and either A, I'm told who it is, or I've already figured out who it is. So now why am I reading the rest of it? With this book, I was never sure. Until at the page before when I flipped it over and there's the reveal. And I appreciate that from authors who do that with mystery thrillers. Mm-hmm. You did that perfectly.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. You go. Comment on that.
Well, I was just going to say that the case of Nancy Lewicki was based on a real case. If you ever want to look it up, it's called Dateline. If you go to their archives, it's The Disappearance of the Dairy Queen. And I had the original person who did the crime. He had an interesting way that he confessed. It was actually, I was going to put the character of Ming Li to get his confession, because that's kind of what happened in real life. He happened to have liked Asian women. And that's what the real detective did, put an Asian woman in there and he confessed to her. This is like 30 years later. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to follow that. And my agent said, it's not interesting enough. And I said, are you kidding? I said, that's what happened in real life. Of course it's interesting enough, because I did a whole story around it. And he said, no, it's not interesting enough. So that's when I had to add that additional character, which you guys, is because you read the book, you know who I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I while we're talking about this cold case, I guess this is my next question. It was interesting to me that the cold case is 30 years old. And I wondered if not knowing that you had said it inspired by an actual event, I wondered if you chose 30 years knowing who your reader is. Where I'm going is 30 years ago, I remember so much of what is revealed about Nancy's life. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, Bonnie Bell lipstick, whatever, you know, that's in her handbag. And you introduce cassette tapes. And, you know, I wonder, young readers today, I don't know, well, they probably would know what a cassette tape is, not that old, but that it really would speak to, as we go back in time, the things that we discover were part of Nancy's life 30 years ago, many readers can relate to, which makes her all the more relatable, and her parents and swim teams and, you know, all of the things that come up that felt to me like, oh my gosh, this is a snapshot of my life 30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, it was sort of meant to bring out some nostalgia with the readers, who I feel are the majority of my readers, you know, not people that are in their early 20s, although that UCLA group seemed to like it a lot. But yes, of course. I mean, because to me also, you kind of get into like the twilight of your age a little bit as you get older, right?
Oh, yes.
You look back at those things that are, I hate to say it, but dead and gone. You know, even the technology we thought was so amazing. I still am impressed by the fax machine. I still don't know 100% how that works.
I remember the first time that we used a fax machine at work and we all stood around it amazed. How is this working?
it was amazing when they brought in Selectric typewriters. That was amazing. And then, of course, the computer just blew them all away. But I mean, there's some nostalgia for something that's dead and gone. And I have to say that did play a big part as I was, you know, writing about Nancy. I mean, here's someone that's cold and forgotten. And there's this sort of sensitive guy that wakes it up again. Mm-hmm. And definitely that played on me a lot when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. Because you do get a sense of the nostalgia for things that are gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you did a really good job of mixing in some old L.A. and current LA in this book. The one thing we touched upon this before we went live. If you're in the LA area and you drive by Tommy's Original Burger, go in and eat. Okay, I mean that is a institution in the LA area. I mean, you got to go there. People are talking about, you know, this chain, that chain. I just go, no, Tommy's. But then when you're talking about Nancy's life when she was alive, and you're mentioning, you know, malls and places that she would go to, and I could almost pinpoint which one it was because I'd probably been there at some point during the time I lived in LA off and on. So I wanted to ask you, how important do you think it is as an author to mix in real locations in a fictional story?
Oh, I think, well, unless you're writing like a dystopian novel, or well, even then you could do it. I think it's so important. I think it has a lot of impact. It doesn't have impact, obviously, to the person who's never been there, you know, unless you're talking about Beverly Hills or something where someone's always wanting to go. But I know that everyone gets a little thrill if I'm talking about their neighborhood, they seem to like it a lot. So, and for me, it's fun because it gives me a chance to celebrate places that I've gone or that I go to, whether I like them or not, I still get to celebrate them.
Yeah. So, yeah. Now, how much of it did you have to research, and how much of it, because you live in that area, I mean, how much of it is you've been there so long, you know it? Was there any one place that you had to kind of get in online and check out a little bit?
Well, are you talking about demographic? Not demographic. Are you talking about
geographically, like where the wedding took place?
Okay. Well, I'm admitting I never went there. So a lot of that is going to be, you know, taking a fictional, what do you call it, poetic license. Yeah.
But you also researched it, though. You went online and you checked it out. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Great Google. Great places to get married in LA. So that's just, the technology is wonderful in that respect. But I'll tell you what I wanted to get right, again, was the police procedure part. And this was back in the first book, I went to the Malibu substation because I was going to have one of the scenes take place there. And this is kind of a funny story. I'll make it very fast. And a Sergeant Dan Taylor showed me around, and sorry, for people who've seen me talk before, they're going to hear a repeat a little bit, but it's just such a strange story. This guy showed me around the Malibu substation, and showed me the drunk tank, showed me where the detectives sit, showed me where the search and rescue helicopters are. They're green. And so we went around, and then when the book was published, I wanted to give him a copy. So I went to the substation and I wanted to give him a copy as a thank you. And they told me that there's no such Sergeant Dan Taylor. And I said, well, maybe he was transferred. And I said, check your database. And they're looking at me like, you know, here's this crazy author holding her book going, hey, I got a book. And they said, we checked our database. There's never been a Sergeant Dan Taylor. There is no Dan Taylor. And they started looking at me funny. So I got out of there. And that man is in the acknowledgement page of the first book. But I don't know where he is. I'm sure that day. Yes, about certain geographic locations, you do want to do your research.
yeah, you definitely. I mean, I had a story that I had to rewrite because I found out that the sandbar in the middle of the river that I saw on Google Earth wasn't there until a big hurricane came through and completely rearranged the river.
Sure, that can happen. Yeah.
So yeah, you got to be careful. You know, you can look and see what it looks like now, but if you're talking about something that happened 30 years before, you also got to go back and check that too.
Well, like I was in Bodie, like you know the ghost town that I
ghost town. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to someplace like that unless I mean I have memories and photos of my own from that at that time. So I knew what was standing there at that time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I could describe the ghost town as she would have seen it.
Yeah. Because you know, somebody out there will know. And no, go ahead. It's just, they'll know and they'll be on the line with you, you know, yelling at you for getting it wrong. Go ahead, Bobby.
Lori, I just wondered if you could just take a moment and tell us what inspired the title. Where does that title come from?
Well, yeah, I would love to know how it affected you or what you thought of it. The reason is I kind of wanted to keep the series in a theme. First book's The Dark Before Dawn. The second book is Deep Into Dusk. The third book is The Mask of Midnight. I sort of wanted to keep the sort of the journey around the timeline. Mm-hmm. So to me, in Twilight's Hush, the reason I named it that is because twilight is the time caught between day and night. And it's not dusk, because dusk is just about when night's going to fall. Twilight is more kind of a magical time. Mm-hmm. And I did think of that title, by the way, before Stephanie Myers wrote Twilight, or at least I already knew I was going to make the fourth book in Twilight's Hush.
And I don't like clowns either.
Huh?
I don't like clowns either.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
There's a little bit of clown stuff.
Yeah. And you don't even need to know about John Wayne Gacy to dislike clowns.
Yeah, he was something else. Okay, we gotta take another break here and fit in another commercial so everybody kind of kick back and relax for 60 seconds while we hear from Tuscany Bay Books.
Hey everybody, Richard Polinelli from Tuscany Bay Books here. And if you're an author and you've just finished your manuscript, you just got the easy part done. There is editing, formatting, cover creation, marketing, the list goes on and on. But don't panic, because we're here and we can do all of that for you so that you can focus on the most important thing, writing your next book. And if you're a reader looking for your next great read, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com. We have books for the kids. We have mysteries. We have thrillers. We have westerns. And we have some of the best science fiction being written by award-winning science fiction authors who will tell you an entertaining story, not send you to your therapist with message fiction. So again, readers and writers, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com and get ready to set sail on your next great adventure.
All right, and we are back here on the Writer's Block. Isn't it amazing I do that commercial and my lips never move? I don't know how I do that. Anyway, we are back with our guest, Lori Stevens. We're talking about her book, In Twilight's Hush, but we want to talk to her a little bit about her writing process, what she does. You kind of brought up the pantser, so we're going to have to ask you, are you a plotter or are you a pantser?
I was always a pantser. I would write a paragraph of the beginning, paragraph of the middle, paragraph of the end, just so I would know about what needed to happen in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And then I would just start writing. And I like that because I feel that allows that organic process that you were talking about earlier, Richard, where it sort of, you get the surprise and the book goes in a different direction, or the characters go in a different direction, and it allows them to be a little more organic and not so stilted. But that said, as I'm getting older, I'm starting to want to see, especially in more complicated books, because I want to challenge myself a little bit. I'm starting to find how valuable the outlines are, that they can just save you from, you know, throwing your computer against the wall. So,
yeah, it's getting expensive to replace computers, so you don't want to do that. Yeah, I mean, I myself, I start with the first chapter, then I go and I write the last chapter. And in my head, I have a rough idea of what I want to happen, but I go back to the end of the first chapter and just set sail. And it's, you know, I know where we're going, but let's see how we're going to get there. And every once in a while, I get surprised. Yeah, but I'm like you. As I've gotten a little older and gone on a little bit, especially now that I'm doing a series of space opera, you've got to have the outline because you've got stuff coming that you've got to set up. You can't just throw it in; it won't work. So, you know, I'm with you on that. I'm probably was more of a pantser in my younger days, but I'm getting more to be on the plotting side of it.
How about you, Bobby? What do you do?
I'm the reader.
She's the reader.
Of this trio. I'm feeling like maybe I could be a writer. 7 years of learning about writing right from the author's, you know, experience. sort of like the music man in the sync method, you know, of how to play music. but I'm the reader. I mean, we all are, but I don't come to it as a writer. I come to the books as a reader.
Okay, I'm calling you up next week. All right, Bobby. Hey.
I think that I guess my question for you might be a little bit about dialogue writing and talk to us a little bit about how you approach dialogue, and do you read it out loud, and just talk to us about dialogue.
Some of the scenes, this goes also back to the writing process. Some of my scenes I write in pure dialogue only, because it comes to me sort of as a conversation first. I want to know what the characters, what their struggle is in that scene, what they're trying to get out of. And before I can fill in all the details of smell or setting, where they are, I want to know what they're talking about. What's the conversation going on, unless it's a scene that just happens to have no conversation. So I tend to write the dialogue first, and then I'll fill in the scene around it. And that gives me a lot of time then to go back and rewrites and make sure that dialogue's going real smooth. But I find that when it comes out organically, you also have to be careful, because the way you talk to someone is not necessarily going to look good on a page or get to the point fast enough for what. So you have to spend some time constructing the dialogue so that you get the most bang for your buck, but at the same time, it looks very natural. And that is sometimes a challenge, especially when the thing you want to say in the scene would take a lot longer than if you were going to just try to have a normal conversation, a dialogue. But if you're writing it down and it has to propel the scene and the story forward, that takes a little more thought sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things you have to cut out or substitute.
Just to go along with that, there's a scene between Gabriel and Nancy's past best friend from her youth, I think Jenna Goldman Klein, and they meet, and they have dialogue. I mean, there's dialogue. They're sitting down in a diner, and you know, they're chatting over coffee, I think. But it's a short scene, but the way that you crafted that scene, the way Gabriel looks at her when she enters, and you're already telling us so much sort of through his eyes before they actually speak, that we feel we have a full scenario there. And I noticed that other times too. The actual dialogue is, you know, we get through it pretty quick, but you've given us a whole environment of that dialogue.
I had to. There wasn't going to be enough time in that scene to, I know which scene you're talking about. It's them at the restaurant, it's a great restaurant right on Pacific Coast Highway in San Diego area. What is it called?
I should have written that down.
Anyway,
I think I've been there too.
If you're ever in San Diego, you'd want to go to that restaurant. But it starts with a V. Anyways, I had to do that just to save time. I didn't want to do a very long unfold of her, but there was a lot about her character that I needed to get out. So I had to get it out like in under a paragraph. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, let's have him expect this teenager to walk in. And again, that goes back to the whole nostalgia thing. It's how we look at, you know, our lives as time passes by. You know, he remembers her from Nancy's notes and from the old detective's notes as a teenager. And he just is stunned when this older woman walks in, and she's zaftig, and she's got a Band-Aid on from getting blood drawn, and she's wearing sort of a gaudy purse. And you just learn about her character that way. And it's more to relate back to him, where he's like, what happened? You know, what happens? We, you know, here's this, I'm expecting it like this happy-go-lucky teenager, and in walks this woman who life has just pounded a little bit.
Yeah. how important is it, because with dialogue, you've got all these different characters speaking, how hard is it, or is it difficult for you to have them speaking as each character individually would and not have them sounding like they're all talking alike?
Well, you would know this, Richard, because as a writer, you, every character becomes that person to you. I mean, you, if you may not, like if someone said, write down all your character developments, I hate when you take writing courses and they're, give us a 5-page outline of your character. I can't stand that because the character is in my head already. It's there. The character is real. It's a person that I see in front of me. I can't possibly, you know, paint a picture and give it to you for that. You know, it's going to come out in the book somehow. But when you ask how do you do that, I think the character just becomes like someone you could sit right next to. Yeah. And if they're not that way yet, you should get them that way before mm-hmm. you put pen to paper, so to speak.
Yeah.
The character should be just someone that if you had a conversation with that character, you know exactly how it would turn out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, wait till you write a pirate character and then catch yourself talking like him in real life. It's it'll That's get you. Cool. Bobby, why don't you ask the question?
This is the only question we ask every author. Tell us about writer's block. Do you get it? Do you not get it? Do you believe in it? If you get it, how do you get over it? What do you think?
Oh, God, there's nothing worse. But I find that it mostly comes from self-doubt, where you're sitting there just going, you know what? Why did I even think of this idea? I would rather tell everyone to just write something down and believe that it matters. And then later on, when you go to a rewrite phase and or if you put it away and you're writing something else and then you go back to it and you just go, this really stinks. Have someone look at it. Be part of a writer's group. Or I have some really good beta readers and some friends that are in the writing community. I met them through Sisters in Crime. I met them through Mystery Writers of America. And you're going to glom on with a group of people. Have them read your work. They'll tell you, I was not interested in this in any way, shape, or form. And that while that hurts, it's good. I mean, maybe you'll have to figure out why it's so meaningful to you at that time. Yeah. And then maybe it's not meaningful enough to be in a book. But I don't know. What was the question again?
do you get writer's block? Yeah, do you get writer's block?
I do, but when I think of it as in terms of this is my self-doubt talking, then what I do is I'll either go on a walk, go on a drive, and listen to some music. And the music tends to get me motivated. And I'll come back and maybe I'll be on a scene. I won't write that scene. I will jump to 10 scenes later and write that scene. And then that will get me motivated to go back. And the other thing is, I find that if something is not working, I'm a true believer, and I don't know who said it. Was it Stephen King said, kill your darlings? I just think if I've reworked something over and over and it just can't fly, I trash it.
Yeah.
At
some point. At some point you got to toss it.
I'm sorry, what? Yeah.
I said, at some point, you just got to walk away. I mean, it's obviously not going to work. So let us take another break, get our last commercial in, and we'll be right back with our guest, Lori Stevens, after we hear from Creative Edge Publicity.
Okay, you've written a book. How are you going to get your name out there? Well, the folks at Creative Edge Publicity will. That's their job. They aren't going to sell your book. They don't want to sell your book, but they will take your brand from the ground up so you are known in your genre and within the writer's community. They'll do this by using relationships with contacts they've made in TV, in radio, podcast, and publishing to get your name and your brand recognized. So why are you waiting? Contact Creative Edge Publicity at www.creative-edge.services or email Mickey Mickelson at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com. Creative Edge. It's your work and it's your brand. Why would you trust it to anyone else? Creative Edge Publicity.
Okay, we are back for the last 5 minutes of the show. It just flies by. It's strange how that happens. Real quick, Lori, as a reader, what are you looking for when you pick up a book and you open it and you dive into that adventure?
Oh, keep my attention. I don't have ADD. It's not hard to keep my attention. But if I have to sit there and feel like turning the page is a chore, I'm not going to finish the, I'm going to put it down. What I look for, I don't need to even have a thrill ride. Just really good, a good story, a good engaging story. And I've read so many different kinds of books, from memoirs to, you know, the dark psychological thrillers, to, you know, biopics. Mm-hmm. As long as they're interesting, just engage the reader. That's all. Make us part of the story.
Yeah. How about you, Bobby?
Ditto. Everything she said.
Yeah. Yeah, I have the first chapter rule. If I'm still wanting to read by the end of the first chapter, I'll finish the book. A couple of books haven't quite made the first chapter, and I'm like, I'll go find something else. And that's important, because the readers are investing their time and money in your story. So, you know, you want to give them their money's worth. And I think we have that as authors. We have that same expectation, because we know what it takes to get a story out there and to the work we do to make it readable and enjoyable. Like I said, we're coming up to the end. So before we get done here, Lori, why don't you tell us where we can find you online and find your books?
Well, you can find my website at www.loristevensbooks.com. And Lori is not L-O-R-I-E, it's L-A-U-R-I-E, and Stevens with a B, books.com. You can find me on any online retailers. You can find me on Goodreads. Anywhere online books are sold. You can even walk into a Barnes & Noble and request the book. So
there you go.
That's what I'd like to do.
You've made the holy temple of Barnes & Noble when you see your book in there, right? That's what we all shoot for.
To order from them. You can walk in and order them, and they'll come in. Yes, the Holy Grail. When you do see your book in a bookstore, it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is, I'm sure.
Lori, thanks again for coming on and putting up with us. And I know Jim is disappointed he wasn't able to be here tonight, because he was looking forward to talking to you. So we will have to get you back on when your next book comes out. Get a hold of the bookie. I can't book you. If I try it, I will be, you know, I'll be a 30-year-old cold case if I try to do that. So we don't want to do that. Next week's guest is Jesse Sternberg, and he has written a book on dog training, which is good timing, because next week it'll be the three amigos, myself, Jim, and Russ Abison. So hopefully, if you'll forgive the pun, hopefully we won't be barking up the wrong tree with this show. I had to get that one out. Lori, hang around till after the end of the show. We kind of chat with our guests after we go off the air. I guess it's time to wrap this thing up. So I better thank our guests. You were great. It was a lot of fun having you on. And like I said, we got to get you back on when the next book comes out. And we'll see what Gabriel's up to in the next book.
Okay.
All right, so let's wrap this thing up. Bobby, thanks for riding shotgun with me. Jim, get better. You know, we want you around here, because it's just chaos when I'm running things.
You did a good job.
Thanks, Sam Hassan, back at the 48th floor of the LA Talk Radio building in downtown Sherman Oaks. Unfortunately, we're in the basement with the, you know, where he's got our recording studio. I don't know how that works. But anyway, Sam, great job as usual. Thank you. And of course, we have to thank the bookie, because without the bookie, Jerry Christina, who is putting up with Jim not being very well right now, this show doesn't happen. So until next week, we are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.